welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Sitalia. We'll spend the half hour with freedom writer and civil rights activist Bob Zellner. Born into a family of robe-wearing Ku Klux Klan members, he became one of the first white Southerners to engage in the early civil rights movement. He organized sit-ins, rallies, and investigations, and for that, he was violently attacked, beaten unconscious, and arrested more than 18 times. He describes his experiences in his inspirational memoir, The Wrong Side of Murder Creek, A White Southerner in the Freedom Movement. Bob Zellner, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Patty. Glad to be here.
Your personal story starts about as far as one can get from where it ended up. Explain how a descendant of Klansmen ended up becoming one of the first white Southerners involved in the civil rights movement.
Well, thank you for asking. I grew up in L.A. in Lower Alabama, and my dad was in the Klan. My grandfather was in the Klan. I was very lucky that my father did leave the Ku Klux Klan. And when he did, his father disowned him, and his brothers never spoke to him again in his life. So very early on, as a small child, I was not totally aware of that struggle, but I benefited from the journey that my father took, from being a Klansman, graduate of Bob Jones College. My mother and father were both graduates of Bob Jones College.
And you were named after Bob Jones.
I'm named after Bob Jones. He's my godfather. And I think I was a big disappointment to him because I was supposed to be. I come from a long line of fundamentalist terrorists, when you think of it. And for me to get involved in the civil rights movement was very unusual. But starting out in South Alabama, I had to do something about it.
Before we find out what it was that sparked your interest in racial issues, I'd like to talk a little bit about what prompted your father. Tell us a little bit about going to Europe with Bob Jones and the sea change in his thinking about race.
Well, this is part of the family history, and we are our own memoirs. We are our own story, and a lot of it is where we come from and who we come from. And my father was a Methodist minister. My mother was a school teacher, and I had four brothers. And my father, going to a fundamentalist college, growing up as a son of a Klansman and a Klan organizer, he was actually an organizer in Birmingham, Alabama, he went to Europe in the middle of the 30s, before the war, with Bob Jones to convert the Jews to be Christians, to save them from his own Nazi ideological brothers. And his experiences there, I asked him if he converted any Jews, and he said no, but they converted me. So his experiences there changed him from being a Klansman. And when he quit the Klan, he began to work with Joe Lowery and Dr. King in the movement. And he was a Southern churchman who spent his whole career trying to undo segregation inside the Methodist Church.
Well, in Europe, it was the first time he saw African Americans and realized that they weren't any different than he was. They were worshiping the same God. They were interested in the same things. And he realized this brotherhood that he couldn't have realized growing up as a member of the Klan.
That's right. He had experiences, and his initial experiences working with the Jewish underground. He was in Latvia and Estonia, Poland, Soviet Union, Germany. And he was working with the Jewish underground. He began to identify with them and not the Nazi oppressors. And I said, well, Dad, that would change you intellectually, but what happened in your heart? And that was when a group of gospel singers from the South joined his little group traveling around Russia. And he said for the first time he lived together with black people. And he thought he was having a nervous breakdown when he forgot they were black. And he said, I will try to remember that. But finally he said, I will let that go while I'm in Europe because they all call us the Americans. And I'll be a good Klansman when I go back to Birmingham. But he said that ruined me as a Klansman. So it was the change in his heart that counted.
You have said that more Germans resisted Hitler than Southerners rejected racism or segregation.
Yes, conformity is so strong. Growing up in a segregationist society, it was tremendously difficult to break out of that. Even though I didn't have the teaching at home of racism, It took me until I was in college and met Dr. King and Mrs. Parks before I decided that I would take action and join the movement. So it is amazing. I ask my history students in university, I say, who is the slaveholder of great power and wealth who at the height of their power freed their slaves and became an abolitionist? And the answer is nobody, not a single one. And so in the civil rights movement itself, white Southerners were very reluctant and very rare to become involved in the movement.
You tell this story, and it is a page-turner in your 2008 memoir, The Wrong Side of Murder Creek, A White Southerner in the Freedom Movement. Really, it took you almost 50 years to write that book, and I'm wondering, what prompted you to finally tell your story?
What prompted me to tell the story finally is, number one, I got some help from Connie Curry, who had done a lot of books on the movement. She helped me in editing that. But it was really going back to James Forman, who was the executive director of SNCC, one of the great figures of the civil rights movement, totally unknown now. And Forman said to all of us in SNCC, make a record, write it down, tell the story. And he knew the importance. He wrote a book called The Making of Black Revolutionaries.
In fact, he interviewed you when you first became a member of SNCC because he was not too sure, is Bob Zellner a spy or is he really interested in improving race relations?
Yes, when I came to work with SNCC in the fall of 1961, Jim Forman was the first person that really vetted me. And he put a big Wallensack recorder, taped reel-to-reel recorder, and he stuck a mic and he said, I want to know why a white cat like you wants to join a black outfit like this. And I started out telling the story. He said, your daddy was in the what? In the Ku Klux Klan, your granddaddy what? So that's the way we started out. And he said, well, your story better check out, brother, because if it does, you, we need you in the movement. But that was the attitude because very few white Southerners went to the front lines. There were lots of moderates and lots of liberals, but very few white Southerners really became an integral part of the struggle in the movement.
In fact, when you spoke out at Huntington College in Alabama, where you went to school, and raised some opposition to the fact that a young black woman wanted to attend the University of Alabama, and this was making a stink, people looked at you like, what are you saying, and that you were a traitor to your race?
Well, when Authorine Lucy was the first black student at the University of Alabama, I would say, I think that's good for Alabama. It's good for the University of Alabama. And people say, don't let anybody hear you say that. Just the least bit of dissent or disagreement from the mainstream would get you in trouble. And they say, well, people will hurt you if you say that. And so that's the way, see, that's the way this conformity has been enforced. In Germany, the people who joined the Jews and fought against Hitler, and they were terribly persecuted. The communists, the Catholics, the gypsies, and all of the people who opposed that regime, they were hunted down like animals. And the very same thing happened in SNCC. The first few months of my work with SNCC, five of my colleagues were murdered. They were lynched.
And you have served time in jail at least 20 times in 7 or 8 states. How difficult was it for you to get a white attorney in the South to represent you? And what kinds of charges did they levy against you?
Well, the charges were pretty ridiculous because actually the charge was tending to free yourself and to free others. And but they came up with everything. The incredible thing was that in my state of Alabama, which was a police state under George Wallace and John Patterson, George Wallace appointed a Klansman to be head of the Highway Patrol. So it would be like the Texas Rangers joining with the outlaws. You know, so in when we grew up and we started struggling in the South, the police were on the side of the Klan.
They were the Klan.
They were the Klan. It was basically the same. And we were betrayed time and time again by the FBI, for instance. The FBI was against the movement. J. Edgar Hoover hated King. He instituted the COINTELPRO program. Which was spying on movement people. And if you're spending all that amount of time spying on Martin Luther King and Bob Zellner, what's happening to the real criminals? They're robbing banks or something.
In fact, the Attorney General of Alabama called you to his office to say that you were falling under the influence of the communists and that you better stop what you were doing.
Oh, yes. After five of us from my sociology class went to hear Dr. King speak and meet John Lewis and others in SNCC, the church was surrounded, and Dr. King said we were going to be arrested. But we managed to escape. We got back to campus, and our college president said to the five of us, you have to resign from school, because we had gone to an integrated meeting. The Klan burnt crosses around our dormitory. We were called into the office of the Attorney General, and he said, you're under the communist influence. And we said, there's communists in Alabama? But yes, that was the idea, that if you opposed segregation or supported women's rights or wanted to organize a union or something, you were under alien influence. You were supposed to toe the super conservative line.
Tell us a little bit about the so-called Huntington Five, you and your four classmates who took a sociology class very seriously.
Yes, I was in a sociology class studying the racial problem. It was called race relations. And we were assigned a paper to study the racial problem and write a paper about it. So we did our research in the library. We read Gunnar Myrdal on The American Dilemma. We read Casting Class in a Southern Town, Dollard, all of the literature. And then we told our professor that we wanted to go talk to Dr. King and Mrs. Parks. And he said, oh, no, you'd be arrested.
Who happened to be holding workshops in Montgomery.
Happened to be holding workshops right there in Montgomery. And we knew that people had come from all over the world to study what had happened in Montgomery. And we told our sociology professor, Dr. Arlie B. Davidson, how could we not, as sociologists, go and find out about this struggle that is informing everybody in the world? We can't go find out about it? So that's how we got in trouble. They tried to arrest us. We were asked to leave school. We were called into the Attorney General's
office. You were the only one
office.
Who didn't leave.
I was the only one that didn't leave at that time, that some of them came back later and did finish. And I said, don't leave college because they're saying that you have to resign. That's different from being expelled. Two of us had been given the highest honors of the college. And we were in touch with Glenn Smiley from the Fellowship of Reconciliation, Dr. King, Clifford and Virginia Durr, and a great host of Ann and Carl Braden by that time. And so I said to the college administration, I'm not leaving it. You can expel me if you want to. But they didn't expel me, and I was able to graduate that spring of 61, and that's when I went to work with SNCC.
You had something that your four classmates didn't have, and that was family support.
That, Patty, was the key element, because all of them said to me, Bob, you have the support of your father, your mother, your brothers. We have no support at home. And in fact, some of them said, Joe Thomas, I think, said, my folks will help the Klan pick out the limb that they're going to hang me from. So we have no support from home. We had to do what they said. But they all say, even some of the Klan students from that time have come to me since. I was on the Oprah show for the 50th anniversary of the Freedom Ride, which we're talking about here today at Penn State. And some of those Klan people said, you know, we were opposing the Freedom Riders. We were opposing SNCC. But, Bob, you were right, and we were wrong. We just didn't know it at the time.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Our guest is Bob Zellner. His memoir, The Wrong Side of Murder Creek, A White Southerner in the Freedom Movement, describes his experiences in the early civil rights movement in gripping, often horrific detail. I read first-person accounts of a number of people who were involved in the movement, everyone from John Lewis's account to Jim Zorg and yours. And one of the things that impressed me so much was the commitment was so strong that when you were looking death in the face, a certain calmness seemed to come over you that allowed you to carry on.
Yeah. Well, Patty, you know, we made the decision that we wouldn't be doing that if longevity was the main thing, that we wanted to live. We didn't want to be martyrs, but the first Freedom Rides came to Montgomery when I was still a student, and I organized some students to go down there to the bus station.
help.
To try to, at least, we didn't know much about nonviolence, but at least we would try to keep somebody from being killed. But by the time we got there, the Freedom Riders had been brutally attacked.
The bus had been torched.
The bus was burned. The people were beaten. Cameras were laying in the street. Blood was covering the street. And I went to St. Jude's Hospital in Montgomery to where Jim Zwerg and some of the Freedom Riders were. And I said to Jim Zwerg, "Your Freedom Ride is over." And he said, "Oh, no. As soon as we're able to get back on the bus, we will." And the man couldn't walk. He couldn't see. And I said, "Jim, if they treat you like that in Alabama, they're going to kill you when you get to Mississippi." And everybody thought they would die when they got to Mississippi. He said, "We know. We've written our wills." So that was how strong it was.
And Jim Zwerg, a white northerner, was disowned by his family. He thought he was out doing what he was taught in his Christian family.
Yes, yes, yes. And was a tremendous example to all of us, because sometimes the white students were singled out for brutal treatment in all.
Because you were
all
considered a race traitor.
Yes, which actually was a left-handed compliment to the young black men and black women who were making the movement, because they were saying they have an issue. They have a right to revolt. But you're privileged. Why would you revolt? So they actually realized that it was something to revolt against, but we're not supposed to help the black people. Well, I didn't go to help the black people. I was not free. I fought for my own freedom and the freedom of everyone.
The interesting thing is that Jim Zwerg felt a tremendous amount of guilt that his story made the news. It made newspapers worldwide that this white northerner was almost killed in the struggle for racial justice. And he thought, why am I, of all the people out there, getting this attention when so many blacks are so dying? Is that a dilemma that you ever struggled with?
It happened over and over again. By 1964, numerous people, black people, had been killed in the movement. Herbert Lee, Lewis Allen. And when the three civil rights workers, two white New Yorkers and a black Mississippian, when they were killed, it was worldwide news.
James Chaney, Andrew Goodman,
and Mickey Schwerner.
Tell us something that you write about your first experience marching. We're talking about Macomb, Mississippi.
Yes, the 130 students from the Berglund High School marched out of school to protest the murder of Herbert Lee and the expulsion of Brenda Travis, who was a 14-year-old high school student. So I was my first SNCC meeting, and I said, how can I be in SNCC without joining? But to make a very long story short,
it wasn't your first SNCC meeting, it was your first SNCC march.
My first SNCC march, absolutely. But we went, and as we were marching down to the town hall, a mob formed of 400 or 500 people, and we were blocked. And the students stood up and prayed on the steps, and the police would arrest them one at a time. And a little group started hitting me. And Bob Moses and Chuck McDoo, both black staff members of SNCC, came to stand between me. That was the nonviolent way. If somebody is being attacked, you go and take some of the punishment. You don't fight back. But the police came over and banged them in the head, bursted their heads, and blood all over the place, dragged them off. And the big group out in the street said, "Bring him here, we'll kill him." And they picked me up and were carrying me into the street, and I took hold of the rail down the City Hall steps. I didn't know much about nonviolence, but I had been a martial arts instructor when I was in college. I was in good shape, so I just held on. And when they pulled, I would hold on, and when they came back for another pull, I would move up the rail. They were so frustrated, 12 or 14 grown men, they couldn't pull me loose from this rail to kill me out in the street. One man came over the back of my head with his fingers and started trying to get a hold of my eyeball. And he would work my eyeball out of the socket, practically, and try to get it between his thumb and forefingers. And I would move at the last minute, and my eyeball would thunk back into my socket. And, well, I had all kinds of irrelevant thoughts. And number one, and I thought, that eyeball is a very tough little muscle. You think of the eyeball as being like a grape. You could just mash it. But it's a very strong muscle. And finally, they just piled on top of me, knocked me loose from the rail. And the last thing I remember is my head sticking out of the pile being kicked by a boot. And I said to myself, before I lost consciousness, this is the way that I die. So I was almost killed in my first demonstration. And after that, I was not afraid of anything. It was all lanyap, as they say in Louisiana. It's all extra. And I have some higher power that's watching over me.
Many in that situation say that they come out of the movement with a confidence and a discipline that they would have never had had they not been involved.
Oh, it's absolutely true. I mean, almost all of the people who were able to come in the summer of 64, which we're celebrating this 50th anniversary this year, thousands of students from other parts of the country, and many white students from the South, not just me, but a lot of others. That was a life-changing experience. I go on freedom rides now with young people, and just the freedom rides back to those shrines of the movement is life-changing from them.
You say that today we are refighting some of the civil rights victories that you had 50 years ago. Voting rights, for example, is one example.
Yes, Patty. After the civil rights movement, nobody thought that women's rights would ever be challenged again, that voting rights would ever be challenged again.
And, of course, they are every
day. They are being challenged every day. And the right wing now is, now, I don't say Republicans, but the right wing, they're asking John Lewis to walk backwards over the Edmund Pettus Bridge. In 1965, next year, 50 years.
The Voting Rights Act.
The Voting Rights Act. After that bloody confrontation on the bridge, they're asking them to walk backwards across that bridge now and to have a voter ID okay, to have all of these voter restrictions that they're now putting on in my state of North Carolina, for instance. And we can't lose John Lewis's legacy or the legacy of SNCC or all the other civil rights movements.
Before he died, Martin Luther King was changing. He was in the midst of creating the Poor People's Coalition, and his thoughts on nonviolence seemed to be changing a little bit. And I'm wondering if your belief in the nonviolent principle ever wavered.
No, my belief in the nonviolent principle has not wavered. Now, what has happened is that we have a deeper understanding of that. Dr. King, one of the main things he did was to lift the terror against black, especially males, in the South. Because that terror was that if you went to register to vote, if you tried to integrate the school or tried to do any of those things, that you would be lynched, you would be crucified. That, to a large extent, has been taken away. But the legacy of Dr. King is only slightly seen. Nobody realizes that he believed, along with Ella Baker, a great woman leader of the movement, that it's about more than a hamburger. So the liberal consensus took us through the 64 Public Accommodations Act and the 65 Voting Rights Act, which is once again being challenged. But we said we'd have to change those things. There was no liberal consensus to go to a thoroughgoing economic revolution, which is what Dr. King was doing in Memphis, working for a labor union, organizing the Poor People's March on Washington. So 50 years later, we have to complete that struggle.
You actually spent time in a jail cell with Martin Luther King in Albany, Georgia. What was that like?
Well, it was an amazing thing to know Dr. King and Mrs. Rosa Parks. And when they were ordinary human beings, but of great courage and great organizing skills, Dr. King always took an interest in younger people. I was very pleased to be on the Freedom Ride in 1961. I was in jail with Dr. King in Albany, Georgia. And they often talk about Albany as being a great failure, but it was a huge success for the movement. It mobilized a whole community and a whole state, the same way the Montgomery bus boycott had mobilized in Montgomery. So Dr. King, he's a wonderful person to be in touch with, and we can still be in touch with him through those people who knew him and those people who followed him. So millions of people follow him around the world now. And, you know, in terms of education about the civil rights movement, people around the world know a lot more about Dr. King than our students do.
Wow. That must be very upsetting to you.
It is. We need to be able to see Black history not as just Black History Month, but as American history. It's right in the center of American history, has always been and will be until we solve this racial problem.
You ended up attending workshops that Martin Luther King and that Mrs. Rosa Parks attended. At one point, you write in your book that she touched your elbow and said, "Bob, it's not enough just to study this. You need to do something."
Yeah.
What impact did that have?
Well, it had a tremendous impact because five white students had gone from Huntington over to Reverend Abernathy's church to hear Dr. King and meet John Lewis and the others who made the lunch counter sit-ins, the beginning of the youth phase of the Civil Rights Movement. And the church was surrounded, and the police told Dr. King they were going to arrest the five of us white students. And he devised a plan that he would go out the front, and at least we could try to get away, and Reverend Abernathy and Mrs. Parks could take us down to the basement. And when he went around the front, if the police and news people ran around there, we could try to escape. And sure enough, we were able to escape. But while we were waiting for Dr. King to go out the front door, Mrs. Parks, who was a great organizer and not just a tired seamstress, she was an activist with the NAACP. She touched me on this elbow, which I haven't washed since then, by the way. And she said, "Bob, when you see something wrong, you have to do something about it. You have to take action." So that was my introduction, really, to the activist phase of the movement. And I always took that to heart, what Mrs. Parks said. We can feel whatever we want to feel. It's the actions that we take. You have to take action.
I don't know if it's the same elbow, but one chapter in your book is titled Up South, because this battle really is, it happened to you in New York when you were trying to work with the Shinnecock Indians
yeah.
in New York in a dispute over a development going in over an ancestral burial ground.
Yeah.
And the police there manhandled you, broke your elbow.
Yeah, they broke this elbow. Rosa Parks blessed this elbow, and the police broke this one. So, yes, that was at a time when I had been working with the American Indian Movement, with the activists in the movement, since actually 1972, when I went to China with a group of Americans. But there was a situation in Southampton, New York, in the Hamptons, the richest place in the United States, where they were encroaching further on the reservation, which was once 3,500 acres and is down to 800 acres. And they were bulldozing the cemetery. And the activists from the Shinnecocks came out and blocked the bulldozers. And I was head of the anti-bias task force while I was teaching at Long Island University in Southampton. And they asked me to come and mediate. But just the act of coming to mediate between the state police and the Indian nation, they saw me as being on their side. And I was 62 years old, and they beat me, arrested me, broke this elbow, knocked my jaw out of place, and injured my left knee. And I spent the night in jail. That was not in South Alabama. That was in Southampton, New York.
You helped to change the civil rights movement, and I'm wondering, how did the civil rights movement change you?
The civil rights movement changed me in that it gave me a life cause. Once my dad quit the Ku Klux Klan, he became a minister of the social gospel. He worked with Joe Lowry and SCLC. He worked with Dr. King. He worked with the progressive church people all across the South to integrate the Southern church. They haven't done a great job of it, but the Methodist church is a much better place for that struggle. The way it changed me was that it gave me a way of living out the gospel of Jesus when he said, go to the catacombs, take a risk. You know, the early Christians had to draw a fish in the dust to see who else might be a Christian in the group. That was on pain of death that you would be a Christian. So I knew that to be a real Christian, you had to take a risk, and you had to confront the issues of the time, and segregation was that issue. And if I had to put my life on the line, I could do it with thousands of other young people.
Bob Zellner, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Pat.
That was civil rights activist Bob Zellner. To read an excerpt from his gripping autobiography, The Wrong Side of Murder Creek, A White Southerner in the Freedom Movement, check the links at our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.